Welcome to DC EKG, where we diagnose Washington, D.C.'s policy diseases and provide needed prescriptions. I'm Joe Grogan, along with Eric Euland. We want to thank our sponsor, Survivors for Solutions, which is run by our very talented producer, John C.Z. Swartacki. John is a survivor himself, and he fights to make every patient a survivor, both today and tomorrow.
Today, we're happy to have Bill Hammond from the Empire Center. He is a senior fellow for health policy, and he is a resident in Saratoga, New York. He's been a longtime journalist, I think 30 years at the New York Daily News before he pivoted to the Empire Center. Graduate of Harvard University. Bill, for those of you who don't watch Bill's Twitter feed, it's a wealth of information. He does a tremendous amount of data dumping on his Twitter feed, and it's a fascinating place to go if you're interested in health policy. From a personal perspective, Bill had been on my radar screen for a few years, but he really, I think, exploded during COVID and his coverage of the COVID story at the Empire Center and really digging into a number of critical stories that were unfolding in New York. So, Bill, maybe we'll start a little bit with, you know, who you are in your career, how you got started in journalism leading up to joining the Empire Center.
Well, my first real job was at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. I was in their communications office for a couple of years. And in that job, it was my first experience of writing for a living, but also I was working with journalists, and I decided I wanted to become one. A job opened up at a small town newspaper in Glens Falls, the Glens Falls Post-Star. I had to take a pay cut to do that because, I mean, I wasn't making a lot of money at RPI, but newspapering is and continues to be a pretty poor paying job. But it was a great decision. I was there for a little over 2 years at the Glens Falls Post-Star, but it felt like a lifetime. A small town newspapering is such a great experience because I got to cover school boards and county boards and criminal trials and environmental policy. And there was a big fight over the future of the Adirondacks in those days that gave me a lot of fodder. It opened my eyes to a whole side of life that I was completely oblivious to. I think most people are oblivious to how local government works. They dimly aware that they have a local government, but they probably have never been to a meeting that, you know, maybe they vote, maybe they don't vote. They get their tax bills and that's about it. When you see it up close, it was the beginning of my kind of political education of understanding how government works, how politics works, and also more importantly, how they don't work, like how flawed they can be and how sort of structurally problematic. That old saying about how democracy is the worst form of government except all the others, this was like an education in the first part of that sentence. I moved on to another small town newspaper in Schenectady. From there, another general assignment reporter. I got to fly in a blimp, and I got to do interesting stories.
Flying in a blimp is awesome. Sorry to divert for a second, but I too have had that chance. And I'll tell you what, those guys, because you're flying in three dimensions, and you're affected by the wind, thermal currents, what's coming up from below, what's coming down from above, and unlike an airplane or a helicopter, they have this amazing challenge that they're doing with both hands, both feet. They've got this giant wheel that makes you make them appear to be old-time sea captains that they're busy spinning in order to try to stay level. It's just fascinating. I'm so glad you brought it up because I know it's a diversion, but wow, it's a heck of an experience. Anybody who ever has a chance to fly in a blimp, I encourage all our listeners to do it at some point in your life.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I didn't know about that is that it launches and it lands a little bit like a boat, and so there has to be people on the ground to catch you as you come down. There's these ropes hanging down, and They're literally catching the ropes so that you don't blow away. So anyway, I was at Schenectady had a bureau at the state capitol. And when that job opened up, I applied for it. And I was stationed at the capitol full time. They have a press room right in the historic building there. And so that I arrived there in the middle of, I guess it was, Pataki was governor. And wait, am I getting that? Yeah, Pataki was governor. Spitzer had just been elected attorney general. Schumer had just been elected state senator. One of the first stories I covered was the recount of Spitzer's attorney general race. So that was that. That took me to the next level of coverage. I moved to a little paper called the New York Sun in 2002, and then to the Daily News in 2005. I continued to be in Albany at the Capitol Bureau on behalf of the Daily News editorial board. It was a little bit of an unusual job. I was writing editorials and a political column.
Bill, sorry. Is that normal to have for newspapers to have both the news side and the editorial side
No.
deployed out in the field? Now, why was this arrangement, sounds unusual, in existence there? Why did they do it like that?
Well, so the opinion editor at that time, Arthur Brown, a great newspaper man who'd been at the Daily News for a long time, first of all, he appreciated how much of New York City's fate was determined in Albany. And
does New York City appreciate that? Yeah.
The Daily News did its best to inform New York City of that. Most New York City newspapers, actually, the Post, see, that was part of his thinking. The Post had a really strong Albany bureau at that time. And out of that Albany bureau came a lot of commentary about what was going on in Albany. He wanted to be able to compete with that. And that, so hiring me was sort of part of his.
So what was Fred Dicker writing? Was Fred Dicker yes. a Post? So he would have been a competitor of the Sun at that point.
Well, and the Daily correct? News. He probably considered the Daily News more his competition than
right.
the Sun. He was another legendary figure in Albany journalism, now retired, but he was their bureau chief and a weekly columnist. So my newspaper career kind of ran out in 2015. The Daily News was downsizing and I was unemployed for a little while, and then the Empire Center came along. It's a think tank. It's kind of free market oriented think tank based in Albany, focused on New York state government and policy. And they offered me a job focused on healthcare. And
what interested you?
I had spent a certain amount of my, especially when I was at the Daily Gazette, one of the areas that I did dig into quite often was healthcare policy, both just as a local story and also as a state issue. That probably the biggest scoop that I got when I was at the Gazette related to healthcare was in the aftermath of 9/11, in December of 2001. I knew the governor was going to be putting out his budget soon. And so I started calling around different healthcare interest groups to say, so how bad is it going to be? How deep is he going to cut you? Because the state was in a financial crisis. The country was in a financial crisis at that point. And the attack had affected Wall Street. And Wall Street is like the cash cow for all of New York State. So I called these groups, hospital groups and other healthcare groups, and I said, so how bad is it going to be? And they kept saying, actually, no, we're expecting a big increase in funding. There's this deal coming together. The healthcare union 1199 is secretly negotiating with the governor to raise taxes on cigarettes and to extract a bunch of money from the conversion of a not-for-profit health plan. And he's going to plow it all into the healthcare system and in return, 1199 is going to endorse him as a Republican for re-election. And I thought this was such a bizarre situation. I wrote it up and it ended up being all true. It was a huge deal, billions of dollars. 1199 ultimately did endorse Pataki. It was kind of a pivotal moment for New York State politics. And it also kind of foreshadowed a lot of the work that I do now at the Empire Center, which 1199 is still a major player in health policy. I was just writing about something they're working on this morning. Yeah. So I don't have any professional, like I don't have a master's degree. I'm not a doctor or an economist or a lawyer or anything. I'm just somebody who paid attention as a reporter for many years.
So Bill, why is it that 1199 is so influential on health policy? How is it that they came to be so prominent and a significant driver of both health choices out of Albany, but as well the fiscal side of New York's budget?
Well, they are, okay, just to clarify, 1199 SEIU, it's a branch, it's, you know, it's obviously a branch of SEIU, although I think they're kind of quasi-independent now. And they represent the non-professional, by and large, the non-professional healthcare workers. I think they have some nurses and some technical people, but mostly it's like the orderlies and the custodians and the people who do amazing work in hospitals, and they wouldn't be able to operate without them. And they have hundreds of thousands of members. They used to be concentrated mostly in New York City, but they've since spread to hospitals and nursing homes and other facilities around the state. And they're also just very savvy politically. They have what's called a phone bank, right, where they can directly canvass on behalf of candidates. They do some political donation, but really the thing that elevated them to the next level was that they formed an alliance with one of the state's big hospital groups, the Greater New York Hospital Association. This was in the 90s. And the lead at that time, the leader of 1199 was Dennis Rivera. And the leader then and now of Greater New York Hospitals was Ken Raske. And they got together and they realized that when it comes to getting things done in Albany, they would be more powerful as a team. Traditionally, management and labor are kind of at odds with each other. And that often translates into taking different positions on political issues in Washington and in Albany. But they decided, no, we're going to work together. And they had a mutual interest in maximizing revenue from Medicaid. And they formed something called the Healthcare Education Project, which is active to this day, which is mainly like it runs TV ads and radio ads. And so they will use that vehicle, which has a budget of millions of dollars, to run campaigns either for or against the proposals that they want, and probably more significantly for or against the politicians who support them or oppose them. And they have a demonstrated ability with those ads to affect a governor's poll numbers. So one governor after another, it used to be the tradition in Albany was the governor was always trying to rein in Medicaid. So they'd propose reforms that were supposed to save money. The Healthcare Education Project would accuse them of throwing patients into the streets with a TV ad campaign, often very, you know, pulling the heartstrings kind of ad campaign. The governor would see his poll numbers go down and he would have to you know, back down to some degree and reach an accommodation with the legislature. The legislature would generally side with the healthcare interests. So that was that alliance really, they became the 800-pound gorilla in Albany. And year after year, the teachers' unions are also very influential. I guess the other thing, and this is kind of a truism in politics, is that there's a hospital in pretty much every legislator's district. And those hospitals are very important to the constituencies. Their boards are full of wealthy and influential people. And so politicians are just very reluctant to cross hospitals. And so when the management and the labor of hospitals are working together for something, it's just politically very difficult to oppose them.
So you said that was a tradition that governors would start out trying to rein in Medicaid spending and then go through this political process. But is that the case anymore, or are we now in a different model in New York?
So the tradition was that when governors came into office, they would, you know, they would kind of have guns blaring. I need to control spending, and Medicaid is one of our biggest areas. I mean, you actually saw it with Pataki, that story I mentioned earlier in 2000. He had been, during his first term, he'd been pretty hawkish on Medicaid and had reformed it in various ways. He, one of his big things was he tried to expand Medicaid managed care, and but then when it came time where he was running for re-election, and New York is an overwhelmingly Democratic state, and he felt he needed to do some triangulation, and he formed an alliance with 1199, really. And so after that, his efforts to control Medicaid were pretty minimal. We then had, we had Spitzer and Patterson, who were both pretty, you know, between the two of them, they only served one term. But they had a similar experience where they tried to control Medicaid and suffered politically as a result. When Cuomo came in, he, again, for his first term, he went pretty strong against Medicaid and enacted some of the most effective reforms I've ever seen. But it was kind of short-lived. The program was kind of contained for several years during his first term, but then during his second term, he came to term. He began to accommodate what the industry wanted, and so what's different now is Hochul became governor and never made a priority of controlling Medicaid. And her first two budgets were the biggest increases in Medicaid spending I had ever seen in my career, maybe some of the biggest in the history of the program. So that's just that's like a sea change that right. Instead of Medicaid being a headache and something that needs to be managed and tamed, she has been treating it as, this is a great thing. The more we spend on healthcare, the better. And it's starting to come back at her now because she has a deficit that she's trying to manage. And she's come to realize that she can't do that without touching Medicaid. And so she's in the middle right now of her first kind of tangle with the healthcare industry.
So, Bill, you've been talking about this a little bit at the Empire Center and on your Twitter feed with the New York Essential Plan. And there was one series of, I don't know if you call them factoids or some narrative that you pulled out, because you're great at research. I mean, it's just awesome to watch you pull these things out with actual numbers in the narrative. But you had something that I think might shock some people, where New York State is proposing buying air conditioning for people with Medicaid dollars. And I'm just wondering if maybe you might want to explain, like, what is the Essential Plan in a few sentences? I mean, how is it defined? And then what's the justification to this air conditioning thing? It's just one example of, I mean, there's a gazillion examples of waste in Medicaid, but the air conditioning one is particularly, it stands out among a sea of waste.
So it's not exactly Medicaid. It goes back to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, where it expanded Medicaid, but it also gave states the option of kind of adding a new layer just above the income range for Medicaid. So not to get too into the weeds, but it's from 138% to 200% of the poverty level. And if states wanted to do that, the federal government would turn over the money that they would have spent on tax credits for that group of people. And the state could take that money from the tax credits and use it to just provide a Medicaid-like program for those people. In New York, kind of improbably, that tax revenue that they were getting from the federal government to run this program turned out to be more than they needed, like a lot more than they needed. The program's running a substantial surplus, approaching $2 billion a year. It covers about a million people at this point. And so the state's looking for ways to use that surplus. It's going to waste. They by law, they can only spend it on this program. The federal government can't take it back. So it's sitting in an account going unused, and they're trying to think of creative new ways of using it. And there's this concept in health policy of social determinants of health. And that's a way of saying the factors in people's lives that compromise their health. So being homeless is a classic example, but also being addicted to drugs, being poor, having a mental illness. All of these things are, some of them are kind of half into health policy, and some of them are just parts of your lives that aren't normally covered by insurance. And so there's thinking in the healthcare world that if we could provide, so you can't cure a homeless person's diabetes if they're going to continue being homeless. If you can get them into an apartment, then maybe you can manage their diabetes. And you might actually save money, because if a person gets into a healthcare crisis, it's going to cost you a lot of money, and maybe you would have been better off getting them an apartment. So that's the kind of thinking behind this air conditioning thing. It's not as, in other words, it's not as crazy as it might first sound. I think it is a symptom of a state having more money right. than it knows what to do with in this one area. And it's also, it's extremely vulnerable to abuse and the slippery slope process, where the idea, I guess, is that, you know, for people who have respiratory illness and certain other conditions, being overheated can be a big problem.
Right.
And so if they're in an apartment that doesn't have air conditioning, that's going to maybe send them to the emergency room. And so you can imagine in some cases that would be a perfectly good investment too.
Right. But they're supposed to be like the whole story is crazy. I mean, just if you take a step back, that the federal government's at $34 trillion in debt, we're giving this money for the essential plan. New York, which is constantly crying that they don't have enough money for various health programs and that they can't pay any money back that they may be attributable to wrongly processed payments and things like that. Like, there's no way they can ever give that money back to the feds. Here they are. They want to buy air conditioners. Okay, fine, but find another pot of money in New York to do it. Not necessarily healthcare dollars, but I just think it's illustrative of screw ups in, you know, in Obamacare, and also how our finances and healthcare are completely screwy. I don't know, Eric, what were you going to say?
Just, it seems on its face that we already have a low income heating or energy assistance program that covers both heating and cooling as a result of legislation passed during the energy crisis of the 1970s. So if there already is a federal pot of money for which support is given for people do have access to air conditioning, and the pot is filled every year and people do access it, it just seems puzzling that New York itself has now decided to, in a particular way, again to Joe's point, try to create a healthcare Medicaid spending pot when there is already a federal pot of money of assistance available in order to accomplish the same policy end.
So I think we're touching on a phenomenon, kind of a deeper phenomenon in healthcare that it took me a long time to wake up to this, and I think it would help if more people understood it. Healthcare is where the money is. You know that old joke about the bank robber, why'd you rob? Well, that's where the money is. Healthcare is where the money is. And it's partly a matter of sort of the politics of it. It's very difficult to say no to healthcare. But it's also the way we structured it, where it's third-party payment. So the consumer has an interest in maximizing their use of healthcare, and the third party payer doesn't always have the right leverage to minimize the use of healthcare. And then layered on top of that, you have a Medicaid system that's based on matching aid from the federal government. And so from Albany's point of view, if they spend a dollar on Medicaid, they get, the healthcare system gets two, or two plus, actually. So they're getting 100% return on their money. Every time they spend a dollar on Medicaid, they get $2 back.
Explain that, Bill. Like, explain the how this Ponzi scheme works.
Well, so Medicaid is jointly financed by the states and federal government. The idea is that the federal government will pay, it will match spending by the states on the program. It originally was like a safety net program for the indigent and the disabled. It's kind of expanded now. And in New York, it covers a third of the population. The state puts up, it puts up sort of like 35, 40% of the money. In New York, we force local governments to put up a little bit as well. And then the federal governments match that. There's a different matching rate for every state. New York's matching rate is theoretically 50-50. I think it works out to be more like 55-45. But so there's a kind of a joke around Albany that Medicaid is a verb. And what that means is if you can figure out a way to take an existing program, say it's a program for putting air conditioners in people's apartments, if you can figure out a way to turn that into Medicaid, the federal government will pay more than half of the cost. And if you are part of kind of the government industrial complex of Albany, that's just gravy, right? Like that's money for jobs, that's money for constituents, you know, you're bringing home the bacon. And like I say, it's very hard to say no to healthcare because people take for granted that it's about people's ability to live and survive and be healthy. And when you layer on top of that the idea that you're doubling your money, it's kind of like buy one get one, right? You put up $1 billion and the healthcare system gets $2 billion, and it's an entitlement. There's only a limited amount that the federal government can do to control that. And so that, like, this is why I say this is where the Medicaid healthcare is where the money is. People in the healthcare industry have figured this out. They figured out that there's like bottomless demand for healthcare and there's bottomless funding for it. And it's kind of interesting because the industry spends a lot of time trying to convince us that they are starved for money. And so that's their whole lobbying message. And that's what these ads paid for by the Healthcare Education Project. That's what they're saying. But if anybody who pays attention to healthcare financing knows that actually our healthcare system is replete with money.
Right.
We're the most expensive healthcare system in the world. And New York is probably one of the most expensive in the U.S.
Sure.
So it's not necessarily well spent, and there are definitely areas where people are going without. But
so Yuland and I are geeks, so we could spend hours just talking about Medicaid and the financing and the. But I want to get to, I think, where a lot of people started, who maybe weren't in New York, really started to pay attention to Bill Hammond's operations now, or excuse me, your output and what you were up to and your work product. So your career in Albany covering the Capitol, you watched this transition from a robust competition between Republicans and Democrats for control of various offices to now the Democrats control everything, Attorney General, both Senate seats, the Senate, the Assembly, the whole program. And whammo COVID hit. Now you're covering COVID. Both Eric and I were at the White House dealing with this nightmare that's unfolding across the country. Can you kind of talk about your experience and then some of the observations you had and then some of the data you started to unearth that really had a big impact upon New York State politics and frankly, national politics, because, you know, it helped unseat Governor Cuomo. In my opinion, you may disagree, but I think when you look at some of the reporting that was picked up in the national media, it really hurt Governor Cuomo.
I mean, so I think like most people, well, I guess I want to start off by saying I hadn't paid much attention to public health, strictly speaking. The old fashioned meaning of public health is thinking about healthcare at the population level instead of the individual level. So it's public health is not something that a doctor in a hospital does. It's something that people do in you know, anonymous bureaucratic labs and offices. So I think the country and the state had kind of dropped the ball on the public health system to some extent. And also, so like most people, COVID was like this distant threat that I was hearing about, and then it started cropping up in the news. I think everybody remembers seeing that video of a Chinese construction project where they were building a hospital at lightning speed. And that was sort of impressive on two levels. First, it was like, imagine the United States trying to organize a construction project like that. But also, how scary must it be in Wuhan right now that they need to build a hospital that fast? So that, I think that was the first time I realized, well, this could become a really serious issue all around the world. But like most people, I was kind of complacent about what was going on in the U.S. But it was, you know, I was paid to pay attention to health policy and I was paid to pay attention to Cuomo. So when I watched those briefings like everyone else, only it was my job to do so. I'm sitting, you know, we were all locked in. Even before we were formally locked in, I was working from home. I think a lot of people were doing that. I was able to work from home. So I was sitting at my dining room table watching these briefings and blogging about it. I did a lot of blogging, trying to gather as much data as I could from New York, from other states, from the US, around the world. These data sources started popping up kind of organically. For the first several weeks, I was just sort of, I didn't have like a take on it. I was just trying to figure out what was going on, and it seemed to be pretty horrible and things were going very badly, especially in New York. In retrospect, it turns out that what happened in New York was one of the worst outbreaks that for that first 6 week period, it was one of the worst outbreaks anywhere in the world. I had developed an immunity to Cuomo's charm earlier in my, so I wasn't going to get sucked into the mania that developed around him. It was almost a cult of personality. He developed a lot of fans because he was seen as being in contrast to President Trump. He was taking the pandemic very seriously, and he was very visibly engaging and acting and issuing all kinds of orders and dictates. The rest of the country was kind of getting to know him for the first time. I had already kind of gotten over that. But on the other hand, I wasn't inclined, at least in those first weeks, to fault him for anything, because I understood that he was as overwhelmed by this as anybody else. And then stories started creeping out about this order he had issued requiring nursing homes to accept COVID-positive patients being transferred from hospitals. The first story about it appeared on the day that the order took effect in the Wall Street Journal, and it quoted nursing home industry people saying what a bad idea it was. But that there was so much going on in those days that barely pierced anybody's radar. But then stories started coming out about how bad things were getting in nursing homes. And there was a lot of back and forth over, well, how many people have died and who's keeping track of that? And did that order cause the pandemic in nursing homes? And then what really piqued my attention was when the Cuomo administration started hiding the data. When they changed the way they were accounting for nursing home deaths. At first, they weren't accounting for it at all, which wasn't that surprising because this was such a new situation. But then they started putting out numbers every day. And then they changed the way they put out those numbers and they subtracted what turned out to be about a third of the deaths in this, to get into the technicalities. They weren't reporting people who died in hospital, like nursing home patients who went to the hospital and died there. They only counted people who literally died in the nursing home. It was an arbitrary thing. And they didn't like hide the fact that they did that. But when reporters said, hey, how many patients are you leaving out? How many people went from the nursing home to the hospital and died in the hospital? And they said, no, we can't give you that number. And everybody knew they had it. So that was a sign that they felt vulnerable about what had happened. They felt they were hiding data because they were concerned that it was going to make them look bad and that they would be blamed because of that original directive on March 25th about sending patients into nursing homes. At first I thought, okay, they're going to have to back down on this. They can't keep hiding that data forever. It's going to come out. Somebody's going to file a Freedom of Information request and they're going to have to fork it over and they're going to be embarrassed, but they're making a mistake by hiding this data. So the sooner they pull off that Band-Aid, the better. Well, months went by and they still weren't releasing it. And the health commissioner got called before the legislature to testify, and members of the legislature were asking him, so, you know, give us this missing data. Tell us what the real number of nursing home patients is who died. And he wouldn't give it to them. It was clear he had the information. He just wasn't willing to share it. And he had a kind of mealy-mouthed explanation.
And who was that?
He was concerned that Howard Zucker. Took me a second.
Yeah. Who is now at the CDC.
And by the way, yeah, he's now a deputy director of the CDC. He clearly had the information. He had a mealy-mouthed explanation that he was concerned about it not being accurate, but he wasn't willing to share it with the legislature. That was in August of 2020. And when I said to myself, okay, I have to file the Freedom of Information request. I remember I was in the Adirondacks. I was sort of technically on vacation, but this was too interesting to miss. And so I was watching the hearing from my family cabin in the Adirondacks, and I typed up a Freedom of Information request and sent it in. And the health department started doing what they always do, which is stalled. I don't know if people are familiar with how Freedom of Information works, but there's a law that says the public is entitled to public records. All you have to do is ask for them. But then the agency has a certain amount of leeway in how quickly they get back to you with it, because, you know, maybe your request is just very difficult for them to respond to, or maybe they're getting tons of requests. And so they do have a legitimate right to take a certain amount of time to respond to requests. In this case, they kept postponing me. They kept saying, we can't get it to you. We need another 6 weeks. We need another 6 weeks. We need another 6 weeks. Because of it, at some point it dawned on me, I should be sharing with the public what's going on with this. So when they postponed me, it would be either the first or the second time, I wrote a blog post and I said, the Cuomo administration is is hiding the data on nursing homes. And they, you know, I've requested by FOIL and they're giving me a runaround. And then I had the advantage, we have an affiliated group with the Empire Center called the Government Justice Center, and they do public interest litigation. So they were in a position to enforce the Freedom of Information Law by going to court. So we filed a lawsuit, I believe it was in early October of 2020. We'd already been waiting a couple months. We'd been getting the runaround. We filed a lawsuit. So that was another example for us to go public and say, okay, the Cuomo administration has been giving us a runaround on this data. We are now filing a lawsuit. And the thing is, there was enough interest in this question. The media would cover that. It wasn't just me writing about it. There were stories printed in the paper. The Empire Center is suing the Cuomo administration. The Cuomo administration is hiding this data. It was an interesting situation because we had we had leverage because of the intense public interest in this question. We had leverage that the ordinary person requesting records does not have. So every incremental development in that lawsuit was an opportunity for another story and to once again remind the world that Cuomo was hiding this information. And the thing is, it was a really strong case. We had a pretty ironclad case that we were entitled to those records and that we were getting delayed illegally. Meanwhile, Cuomo's kind of riding high in the polls. He's publishing his book. He wins, what was it, an Emmy he won for the TV?
Yeah, the press conferences, the right?
Daily briefings.
Yeah, he won an Emmy for that.
It was kind of an honorary Emmy. And meanwhile, our lawsuit's cooking along. Then the attorney general puts out a report and she says, we've investigated the situation with the nursing homes. And we believe the Cuomo administration is hiding the number of deaths, and we think he's hiding about a third of the number of people who died. He's not reporting publicly. And shortly after that, the court ruled that our lawsuit, that we were right, and that the health department had to give us the data.
Wait, Bill, let me stop you right there. With all this Cuomo fighting this, with the back of your head, I mean, you framed our healthcare discussion around that's where the money is. At what point were you starting to like think, wait a second, they're hiding the data. This was a decision. Where is the financial motivation to what they did? What's the explanation for why they were pushing people into the nursing homes and why are they hiding the data? Were you there yet or did that take a little bit?
No, I guess I assumed, and to this day, I still assume that it wasn't primarily or entirely a financial motivation. I think it was a political motivation. I think Cuomo, at some point during the pandemic, I will admit this is speculation on my part, but he came to understand, like those briefings started to become viral sensations. And he was as aware of that as anybody. And he thought this could be big for me politically in my career. And I think he started to entertain the idea that maybe he had a shot at being president. Certainly it was going to help him become reelected as governor, if nothing else, if he was the hero of COVID.
Well, they were already speculating about him running for president at this point. I mean, you're being too modest on this. He was getting
what I'm trying to. Okay, I think it's reasonable speculation, but neither of us can get inside his head, and so
that's fair.
So I think he started to recognize the potential of his image as the hero of COVID for furthering his political interests, and. Writing a book kind of fit into that. He got $5 million to write the book, which in and of itself was a pretty powerful motivation. But also, it was kind of his victory lap. And, he could go on a book tour and he could do TV interviews about how he was the hero of COVID. And this nursing home data was undercutting that narrative. And he was just not willing to allow that to happen. it was a huge mistake. I think, like, even at the time, it was obviously a mistake for him to take that strategy of stalling a freedom of information request for embarrassing information, because eventually it was going to come out,
but,
and it would make everything look worse.
Right.
Than he delayed.
The cover up is always worse than the crime, but I wanted to address that because I had an assumption that part of it was the money, that the hospitals wanted these patients out because of the reimbursement rates. There were stories about that. Is that incorrect? That there was lobbying to get these COVID positive patients out of the hospital and into the nursing home?
So it did come out. And in fact, the Greater New York Hospital Association has confirmed this on the record, that they requested that order. They went to the governor's office. I will say that I have heard this theory that it was financial. I don't think you need the financial motive to understand what was going on. We're talking about mid to late March of 2020. The pandemic was really out of control in New York City. It certainly appeared out of control. It wasn't as out of control as we thought in retrospect, but the numbers were all skyrocketing in the wrong direction. And hospitals were filling up. And there was a belief, which Cuomo publicly aired, there was a fear that the hospitals were going to be completely overwhelmed with thousands more patients than they could possibly handle. And Cuomo was in I think there was a moment of panic for him. And so he was beating up on the hospitals. You guys have to make room. You have to convert every vacant space you have into bed space. He was taking unused state university dorms. He was taking the Javits Center. He was asking, he requested and received the Navy hospital ship. He was, everything about his life for that period of time was, we need more hospital capacity. And the hospitals, he worked very closely with them. They were his political friends and allies. And here he was in the position of kind of beating up on them to do a very difficult thing. He literally asked them, we need you to add 50% capacity. It was one of his executive orders. And so they came back to him and said, well, listen, we have this backlog of older patients. I'm going to assume they were mostly elderly patients. They either came from a nursing home or they're too sick to go home. I mean, they're too frail to go home. They had COVID. They are recovered from the worst of the symptoms, but they're still testing positive. And the nursing homes won't take them because the nursing homes are terrified of bringing this virus into their facilities. We need you. It was present, I believe, and I will stand to be corrected if it turns out not to be true, but I believe it was presented as a triage decision.
Interesting.
You have a choice of allowing hospitals to be completely overwhelmed or, easing that crisis a little bit, but maybe taking the risk of putting the virus into nursing homes.
Bill, did you identify who made the decision to cover up the data in your research?
Oh, I don't think there's much doubt about that, that it all went back to Cuomo himself. He was kind of a micromanager. In some of the language in describing how the decision was made, they refer to it as being the executive chamber, and that's kind of code for the
right.
Governor.
Okay.
You alluded to the fact that this helped end his career. When it did come out that he was hiding the data, when the data was finally revealed, I did an analysis that indicated that it wasn't the only cause of COVID in nursing homes, but it contributed to a bad situation. His people, the way they handled that rollout was really bad, and they ended up getting into a fight with members of the legislature And then not long after that, so he was being accused of bullying members of the legislature. He was being accused of covering up COVID in nursing homes. He was being accused of contributing to COVID in nursing homes. And then the sexual harassment stuff started coming out. And that sexual harassment stuff ended up being the straw that broke the camel's right. back. He was being investigated for all of that stuff. It looked like he was going to be impeached over all of that stuff. It's hard to pull out which part of it was, you know, he was going to be impeached over. But that nursing home mistake that he made was the beginning of the end.
Bill, this has been an amazing conversation, and we look forward to talking to you quickly again in a second part of a two-part interview and discussion with Bill Hammond of the Empire Center. We appreciate you very much for coming on and taking the time with us so far. We'd like to thank our sponsor for the conversation today, Survivors for Solutions, our great producer, John C.Z. Swartacki, our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team, Evergreen. On behalf of DCEKG, this is Eric Euland with host Joe Grogan. Thanks for listening. We'll be talking.